The Tom Woods Show, episode 2192.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, we all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. If you want to understand how the world works, a major piece is understanding economics, and so few people really do. Hence the need for the brand new book, How to Think About the Economy, a primer by our guest today, Per Bieland, who teaches entrepreneurship at Oklahoma State University. Per, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so your book is out now. I didn't realize that, actually. When did it come out? Is it recent?
Well, I mean, there's no actual release date. It was shipped from the printer to Mises University, but then it wasn't actually available for sale until the donors had gotten their copy. So a couple of weeks later. So it's fairly recent.
I see. Okay, good, good, good. All right, so I haven't missed it for too long. Let me say, first of all, what I think is valuable about it is it gets people's brains thinking the right way about the right questions. First of all, it lets them know what the right questions to be asking are, and then it gets them thinking the right way. It's very different from economics in one lesson, and it's complementary to economics in one lesson. Now, Economics in One Lesson is a great, great book, and it really got me thinking the right way. And Henry Hazlitt is clearly, without a doubt, an Austrian school economist, as we can see from all his other books. That book is, it's somewhat subtle that he's an Austrian per se. He doesn't even bother to let you know about competing schools of thought, and nor should he, really, in a super-duper introductory book. Just give me the ideas. Some of that book, I would say, is a little bit out of date today because some of the issues he raises are really not being contested or discussed by anybody. But it's still a great book and it will never be superseded, in my opinion. I say that just because people might think, well, I've already read Economics in One Lesson, so that's all I need. This book, I think, situates you within economics in such a way that while Economics in One Lesson lets you know what the key central, I guess, the approach that an economist should take to a particular policy question, namely, we need to look at the long-term effects on everybody instead of the obvious short-term effects on an earmarked group. What you're doing is really complementary to that because in a way, it's even more fundamental. It's introducing the concepts and even what you call the economic problem. And I'm not even sure Hazlitt quite describes the so-called economic problem the way you do. What do you say is the economic problem?
First of all, Hazlitt's book is really, it is one lesson. He wasn't lying.
Yeah.
And it is the lesson of opportunity cost. I mean, he starts with Bastiat's notion that there are good and bad economists, the good ones looking at both sides of the equation and looking at both the short term and the long term, whereas most bad economists, or maybe we should just call them Keynesians, look at the short term effects only, and they don't really care what happens down the line. So, I mean, it's, even though Hazlitt's book has a number of chapters, it's still the same lesson over and over again, applied on, as you said, different policy situations. So what I'm trying to do is something completely different. And I'm trying to introduce basically all of economics to whoever is a lay reader or newbie to economics or newbie to sound economics, perhaps I should say that, right? And I focus on, as all good economists have done since at least Cantillon in the early 1700s, I focus on the economic problem, like you mentioned, and that problem is production. How can we use the little few limited resources that we have to satisfy as many people's wants as possible?
All right, so now let's get into that. First of all, when we say that we're operating under scarcity, some people get confused with that. They say, what? We live in a world of abundance. We don't live in a world of scarcity. But even if we did live in a world, let's say, just somewhat short of the Garden of Eden, there is still scarcity in the economic sense. So the economic sense of scarcity is not the colloquial sense. It refers to limitations. It refers to the fact that, yes, it's true that if I look out into the world, there does seem to be an awful lot of lumber available. There seems to be a huge, huge amount of it. But the problem is there are so many things we could potentially do with that lumber that it absolutely swamps the supply. And then we have to figure out, based on that, what do we do? But then the problem that further arises is the entrepreneurial group, the entrepreneurs in society, have to figure out what it is that people want done. What is most urgent to do with these resources, given that we have so many potential desires and only so much lumber, just as an example, how do they figure out exactly which things the public wants? They can't just send out a questionnaire. Given that there are so many competing uses for this lumber, what do they do?
Well, right. That's the main problem in the economy overall. And there's another issue there too, and that is time. Right? If I start producing now, I won't have the products actually produced and ready for consumers until a later point. If you produce a new model of a car, it can take 10, 15 years before it's actually ready for consumers. So you have to not only figure out what consumers value, but what they would value in the future.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, a different person. It's a different situation. It's a different market. You don't know what kind of competition you might be up against in 10 or 15 years. So that is a huge problem, that production takes time and we have to use resources in the present to produce goods that are of value in the future. And how do you do that? Well, I mean, the Central Planning Committee would not be able to figure that out at all. Instead, the only thing we can do is have as many smart, ingenious people as possible imagine how they can serve consumers in the future. And then they compete with each other for the resources. And that's the only way that we can get even close to satisfying consumers. And of course, history tells us that this system of a decentralized sort of an intellectual division of labor, as Mises called it, right? We have all these people with all these visions and all these imagined goods and services that consumers potentially will like. The system has served us really well since the Enlightenment, when we actually started working with this type of system and sort of got rid of monarchies and these top-down societies.
I want to ask you for maybe a bird's eye view of your book. You're taking the reader on a bit of a journey through economics, but it's not the kind of journey you'd be taken through if you were reading a college textbook on economics. That would take you through a bunch of self-contained chapters. Here's the chapter on this, here's the chapter on this, here's the chapter on this. And there's no sense that we're building something. We're starting with a few fundamental ideas, and then we build to the next thing, and then the next logical thing occurs, and then the next logical thing occurs. I remember having the sense from the economics textbook that I studied from that economics seemed to be a bunch of hermetically sealed concepts that were contained in separate chapters. There wasn't a sense that one leads to the other, and they're all integrated in some way. So can you just give us briefly the story that you're telling over the course of this book?
Yeah, of course. Economics is one system. You can specialize in a specific application of it, but the economic system is fully integrated, and thus economic theory and economic understanding has to be as well. There's no way you can simply say, oh, I'm a labor economist and I only study labor and I know only about labor, but I don't give a damn about the rest of the economy. That's simply not doable because, of course, a laborer is also a consumer and perhaps a father or a mother, anything else in the economy, right? We have different roles, so you can't really focus on one part. You have to understand the whole thing and where this person in this capacity fits. So the story I tell is, the whole point of the book is really to build economic literacy and get the reader to think about the economy in the right way, in a sound economic reasoning, in a sense. So I start out by simply saying, what is economics about? What is the economy? How can we potentially study this at all? And like you said, in textbooks, in university courses on economics, they usually start with, well, they go very quickly to some diagram, shifting curves back and forth, and then the math. And then they start just pushing this math back and forth, doing partial derivatives and all this other stuff. And you don't really get an understanding for what is going on. And my point with the book is that you should get a fundamental understanding so that you can then analyze everything you see on TV. You can immediately see not only that it is wrong, because most people seem to have that intuition nowadays, but also why it is wrong. Why is what they're saying completely well, complete bull, really. What I start out with talking about is after I introduce the economy and what it is and the method, which has to be that we step by step logically go through what is actually going on here, I talk about the market and how the market works and how it must be a process where people interact and act for their own benefit. And then moving on to what is the role of production in this process? It's not simply about exchange and trading with each other. It's also producing to facilitate this trade and to make sure that we can get as much as possible for ourselves out of it, which of course means that we produce for others. So the better I serve other people, the greater my purchasing power in return so that I can buy from what other people produce. And then I move on and talk about where do prices come from? What do prices actually mean? And they, of course, aren't determined by a king or a central planning committee or anything like that. They're not set by corporations either. They really emerge out of people's actions and interactions. And from there, I move on to economic calculation, which is sort of the core to the Austrian understanding of the economy, but a concept that I don't think any non-Austrian has actually understood well or understood at all, in which the core is really what we talked about before, where entrepreneurs try to collectively or in aggregate figure out how to use these resources because they compete with each other, with their visions are sort of pitted against each other, and whoever has the grandest, the best vision gets access to the resources. So the resources get allocated towards what is by entrepreneurs in common considered to be the highest valued ends and the highest valued goods and services. And then from there, when I talked about how the economy as an economy works, basically the free market, how does the free market work? What are the basic mechanisms and processes? I introduce regulations. So the part three of the book is a very short book, but it's still in three parts. Part three is about interventions. What happens when someone starts to meddle with this system of interaction where you have all these market prices that emerge, you have organizations that emerge, you have institutions that emerge. What happens when someone starts meddling with the money supply, adding credit? And that's the chapter on the business cycle. And then I move into talking about regulations in general. What are the actual effects of regulating something in the economy? And there again, we get back to how the economy is really integrated. So regulating a certain phenomenon in some location or in some part of the economy is going to have ripple effects throughout the economy. It's going to cause distortions. And I go through just how big and destructive those distortions are.
All right. There are a lot of things I want to ask you. This is also kind of a big picture question. We remember early on during the lockdown period, some people saying that people like you and me, because I think I can presume where you stood on the lockdown question, we cared only about, quote, the economy. But these people who were morally superior to us, they cared about lives. Do you think that's a reasonable dichotomy?
I think whoever says that is an economic illiterate, because the economy is really just people acting and interacting. That's all there is to it. And by acting and interacting, we also necessarily economize because of scarcity, like you mentioned before. We don't have more resources than we can use, so we have to figure out how to use them the best way possible. And then we interact and trade with each other to satisfy our own wants by satisfying other people's wants. So I don't think you can. It's not a dichotomy. You can't even separate society and the economy because they're just two sides of a coin. It's just two perspectives of the very same thing.
Now for a message from our sponsor, BetterHelp. We've all been there. Something goes wrong, and then shortly thereafter, another thing goes wrong, and then another thing goes wrong. It can be hard to stay in problem-solving mode and not fall instead into overwhelm. Well, a therapist can help you become a better problem solver, and that makes it easier to accomplish your goals, no matter how big or small. Now, no doubt there's been a stigma associated with getting this kind of help, that if you were strong and successful, you wouldn't need it. Well, I can tell you, it's done me a lot of good. First, when years ago I was coping with some grief, and then also there was a time when I just needed a neutral third party to talk some things through with. Somebody who wasn't going to yes me to death, but who was going to listen to my story and give it to me straight. And if you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, accessible, affordable, and entirely online. You get matched with a therapist after filling out a brief survey, and you can switch therapists anytime. Problems you may have thought were intractable can be solved, and that includes stress, anxiety, depression, and more. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/woods today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/woods. Another thing that distinguishes the Austrians, I think, for a layman reading about them, is that Austrians don't deal in gigantic blobs, like just labor as a blob or capital as a blob. We want to know what kind of capital, what kind of projects, what's the time horizon of these various projects. So for instance, because we don't look at things as a blob, we don't say, if you double the supply of money, then we'll just look at money as just a big blob, then prices will tend to double as well. We'll just look at prices as a giant blob. But as you point out, the Austrians tend to want to look on a very micro step-by-step level to get a deeper understanding of what's going on. Why is it, I like your butter example that you give, by the way, why is it that if the money supply doubles, we should not expect prices simply to neatly double?
Right. Doubling prices, I mean, that's jumping to conclusions. That's sort of taking math and thinking that this is how the economy actually works. But if you think about it, if when we wake up tomorrow, any cash that we had and any bank account balances that we have are all doubled, what's going to happen? Well, first of all, the prices have not adjusted yet. The prices will adjust because it's not the case that people realize, oh, look at that. I have $100 in my wallet instead of $50. Now, everything I sell is, I'm going to double the price of that. No, of course not, because you don't necessarily know that everybody else has more money and you don't know that they will necessarily buy what you're selling at double the price. So you have people waking up at different hours and people reacting in different ways to this new money. Some people will say, whoa, wait, look at that, more money. So I'm going to go and just, I'm going to have a blast. I'm going to buy a bunch of ribeyes for tonight instead of the hot dogs that I had planned because I have more money. So you go to the store and you buy ribeyes, which of course means that there's less ribeye left for others, but there's also more hot dogs left for others who come later to the grocery store. And some people are going to say, well, with all this money, I'm going to put some extra in my mattress for a rainy day. So we're going to act differently and at different times, and that's going to have different effects on the prices of those actual goods that we buy. So if you go through this logic and step by step think of, okay, wait a minute, if someone chooses ribeyes over hot dogs, then obviously someone else will not be able to buy those ribeyes. There's going to be less left for whoever comes later, but there's going to be more hot dogs, which means that whoever is a more prudent store owner will probably raise the price a little bit of ribeyes and maybe lower the price for hot dogs, or at least keep the price as it is. And it's those changes to the prices in stores and people's responses to those prices that will determine the new market price with this new money that entered the economy. So even if we would sort of do the helicopter money thing that Ben Bernanke sort of suggested back in the day, it would still not mean that prices would double. But of course, usually in the real world, we can't magically double everybody's cash balances. So usually the money also enters at a specific point in the economy. Say through the banking system, it will enter one industry more than other industries. So the effect will already there be uneven and unbalanced. So there's simply no way that prices will exactly double all across the board because people's behavior will be different, just responding to the different number in the bank account and the balance that they have there.
Yeah, just think in your own situation, would you necessarily want twice as much of everything you ordinarily buy? You were about to go down and buy a stapler, but because you have twice the money, you're going to buy two staplers? Why would you? I mean, one stapler does the job. You know, I mean, unless you have some peculiar reason to need two. I want to know, I've asked this a few times of people who've come on here, because I find this fascinating. The entrepreneur plays a central role in the way the Austrian school looks at the economy. And yet, if a non-Austrian had written a primer like yours, that person would not really place the entrepreneur at the center of the drama that's unfolding. Can you explain what it is that's unique to the Austrian school that makes the entrepreneur so important?
Well, in a sense, it's everything. But I mean, the entrepreneur is really the person trying to figure out how to satisfy consumers in the future. The way I usually say it is that most economists and also people, lay persons who are looking at the economy, they look at what is actually in existence right now. So they see the economy as, well, it's Microsoft and Facebook and Apple and those companies producing whatever it is that they're producing right now. Well, to an Austrian, this is just a snapshot of the process. The process will continue from here, and the process preceded what we have right now too. So the businesses that are in business today are the businesses that survived the competition and the weeding out of businesses not producing enough value yesterday. And the businesses today might survive until tomorrow, but it depends on who else creates a business and creates value for consumers today. And this weeding out, we don't know if Microsoft or Facebook are going to make it tomorrow. And it depends completely on whether an entrepreneur figures out a new way of producing something and then figures out that consumers actually liked it. So consumers chose that product instead. So the whole process is really driven by this entrepreneurialism of the entrepreneurs, figuring out new ways of producing and new things to produce. And of course, if you expunge or exclude this function from the economy, as mainstream economics does, then everything collapses into the supply and demand graph, right? There's no action happening. There's no change going on. And then you can shift the curves back and forth because nothing is really moving and we know everything already. But to an Austrian, everything is this unfolding process. And it's not actually heading in any specific direction. You can't really say that. The only thing that guides this process is how well do entrepreneurs individually and collectively correctly imagine what consumers will value in the future. And that's what drives the whole thing.
So with the Austrian approach, we're dealing, as usual, with a process. So even if we were ever able to get to a point of so-called long-run equilibrium, where we had an optimal, let's say, allocation of resources, and by some miracle, we somehow reached that point, it would instantly be disturbed because people's tastes change, technology changes, the stocks of goods will have changed, and so entrepreneurs have to start again and make sure that in light of these new circumstances, resources are properly deployed. So we never actually get to some resting state where we can all just continue doing the same thing over and over again. So the sense I get is that in mainstream economics, they're kind of assuming away all this most interesting part of the question and just dealing with a kind of long-run equilibrium where we've reached some kind of steady state where everybody's got all the information they need, all decisions are being made correctly, and the thing just runs. And so now we just deal with the prices that would ultimately be reached at the end of this thing. So they don't actually have an entrepreneur who's pushing the economy toward the greatest possible satisfaction of consumer wants, because that's all just assumed away in this static model where we're already there. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what they're doing is really, it's a theory or a study of production management. It's not a theory or a study of the market process as it evolves and unfolds. And I think it's even more to it than what you said, because yes, entrepreneurs are responding to these changes and how consumers' tastes and whatnot else change over time. That's part of it. But the even more important part is that entrepreneurs need to, and they try to, imagine where consumers will be in the future and how they can beat other imaginary products that they will need to compete with in this future. So they're already creating the future in a sense. And in this future, the consumers will choose what products to buy or sell. And there's no way of knowing this in advance, of course. And it's not enough for an entrepreneur to simply, well, it's not simply, but comparatively simply respond to people's changing tastes. Because when you start a new company and establish a new production process, what you're aiming for is not how people's tastes just changed, because you're already too late to that game. What you need to aim for is what will consumers' tastes be like when my product is actually ready. So you have to create that future before the consumer is even there. And in this process, there's simply no way you can use math, and you can't. I mean, you can use graphs as a very highly simplified tool, but many of these methods used in mainstream economics, they're simply inapplicable.
One last thing we'll cover in this episode, then I want to urge people to go out and grab the book. I'm going to skip over the boom-bust cycle thing just because I've somewhat recently done some fairly detailed discussion of that. But your chapter on regulatory intervention is very good, and it picks as an illustrative example the minimum wage. And that's a topic everybody feels like they've heard before. I know what the arguments are. But what makes your chapter on this stand out is that I think you look at it in much greater depth than most people and what the long-term consequences of that particular intervention are. Can you give us a taste of that?
Well, sure. I mean, regulations, usually when we study those, we just take the with or without and we compare those two situations. But what is really important with regulations is how does this change how the market unfolds? And if we regulate some space and the minimum wage, or we prohibit a certain type of production or whatever, whatever entrepreneur would have wanted to go there because they expect consumers to really benefit from a product using whatever technology is prohibited or using whatever resources that they no longer can use, they will need to choose to produce something else that they themselves think is of lower value. So they will not be able to produce the highest value that they envision for the consumers. Instead, they will produce something else. But producing something else means that you also use some other resources. Then, of course, you will outcompete others who are going to use those resources in your not highest valued outcome, meaning simply that through one single regulation somewhere in the economy, you put the whole economy and the market process on a lower trajectory in terms of value creation. So it's going to have a detrimental effect on economic growth in the short and the long term, because we cannot make up for that loss. And as long as entrepreneurs are not allowed to go there and they see that there would be value in going there, it's going to be a loss that is just recurring and recurring and recurring for as long as they at all consider it. So in a sense, any regulation, doesn't matter how small, it's going to have an enormous effect on our standard of living. And it can be something really, really tiny and seemingly innocuous, but it is going to have an enormous effect in the long run.
Well, the book is How to Think About the Economy, A Primer, by our guest, Per Bieland. How do people get this book? Through Amazon, I assume, but I suppose the Mises Institute also has it.
Yeah, exactly. It's on Amazon for all Amazon sites all across the world. And it's $8 from Amazon and $2.99 for the Kindle version, but you can get it from the Mises store for $5. And they also have the PDF and the EPUB versions just to download for free.
Wow. All right. Well, I'll make sure I've got all the links up at tomwoods.com/2192. And I assume you're going to be doing some promo through the Mises Institute for the book. I think I may be one of the first. Am I the first interview you've done?
You are one of the first. Yeah.
Who beat me? Tell me.
I had a couple of, well, they're definitely smaller podcasts. So you're the first big one.
All right. Well, I'm slightly consoled. I thought I was the first one. But anyway, who cares about these petty considerations? The important thing is that people are aware of your book, How to Think About the Economy. Thanks so much, Per, both for the book and for today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. I forgot to mention, actually, that Per is a fellow at the Mises Institute, which is where I originally met him. So, of course, the Mises Institute has a habit of attracting really good and important scholars, and Per is no exception. So definitely check out that book. Tomorrow, our old friend Gene Epstein returns already. We just had him last week, but I have a brand new topic for him. So you know what that means. Got to listen to episode 2193. So look forward to that, everybody. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.